Before we get started, I wanted to say a special thank you to Blue Apron for supporting so many indie podcasters. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone, and they're doing it by supporting a more sustainable food system. Because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, they're reducing food waste. Those who spend a lot at restaurants or high-end grocery chains can now spend under $10 per person for a delicious meal, like one of my favorites, creamy shrimp rolls with quick pickles and sweet potato wedges. I love Blue Apron, not just because it reduces waste and saves me money. I also love the time-saving aspect. Last week, I was on my way home from a late appointment and too tired to stop for groceries. I was doomed to eat circle-shaped pasta from a can. But there it was, waiting for me, my Blue Apron box. And 30 minutes later, I was eating delicious, real food. Blue Apron's freshness guarantee is another reason that I love them, because it promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free, with free shipping, by going to blueapron.com/actual. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/actual. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Good morning. My name is Stanley Mitchell, S-T-A-N-L-E-Y-M-I-T-C-H-L-L. I'm 68 years old. I served 36 years, 10 months, 19 days, and 22 hours in the Maryland prison system for a felony murder. It was the state's position that I drove the car in the crime. It was my position that I wasn't even there. And it took the Unger decision, which is faulty jury instruction, for me to be released on June 20th, 2013.
Hi, this is Brooke, and you're listening to Actual Innocence, a podcast dedicated to spreading awareness of wrongful conviction and cracks in the justice system. This week, you're going to meet Stanley Mitchell. Just a warning, there's a little bit of language and some graphically described violence in this episode. This episode is being brought to you by RX Bar, Blue Apron, Smart Move, and ZipRecruiter. I just wanted to remind you that without our amazing sponsors, Actual Innocence, and really all of your favorite podcasts, would not be sustainable. Also, there are two non-sponsored podcast trailers at the end of this episode. They're not paid. It's just me connecting you with great content. One of a landlord's number one concerns is being paid on time by tenants. How do you know if the renters are the right match for your property? How would you know any of this? Let me tell you about Smart Move and find out what you don't know about your rental applicants, and how you can save 25% off of your next tenant screening. You can get the information you need to help pick the right tenants, and the reports are delivered within minutes. 100% online and accessible from all devices. You just sign up in a matter of minutes, and you can start screening. Plus, there's no subscription fees, no minimums. You just pay per use. Plus, you can include the option to have the renter pay as part of the screening. If you own a rental property, or know someone who does, try Smart Move so you don't find out the hard way that a prospective tenant is an eviction risk. Go to tenantscreening.com, enter code INNOCENT, and get 25% off your next screening. Don't be in the dark about your applicant's rental history. Know your tenants with Smart Move tenant checks. Go to tenantscreening.com and enter my code INNOCENT and get started. With Smart Move, you'll get great reports, great convenience, and great tenants. Do you remember when we talked to Lindsay from the Arizona Justice Project? She told us about the cases of manifest injustice that her agency handles, which, if you need a quick refresher, means when someone is obviously punished in an unfair way. Well, Stanley isn't from Arizona, but his case fits the definition perfectly. So here is Stanley's story.
Originally, I was born in New Jersey, raised in New York.
When you were growing up, what was your family like?
Well, I come from a family of six, but my parents separated when I was five, and I was the oldest. So my father, he left my mother, or they split up, and my father took me with him, but he didn't take me to raise him. He took me to his mother's house, which basically is my grandmother. My grandmother raised me, and I basically seen my father when I needed something or I'd done something I have no business. And my brothers and sister, they stayed in Elizabeth, New Jersey with my mother.
How often did you get to see them?
I was in 25 minutes away, walking distance.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so small town, Elizabeth, New Jersey. They live downtown, and my father lived in upper middle class, uptown, so to speak.
And you were the only child that he took with him?
Yes, ma'am.
How did that feel?
Well, at the time, it didn't feel anything, but as I interacted with them, it became a problem because they felt as though that he chose me over the rest of them. We all had the same mother and father, and a lot of times when I visited, the conversation would be your father this, your father that, and I had to remind them that he's your father too. And they say, well, we can't tell because you're with him and you got your own room, and they're staying in a bedroom four deep. And I had my own bedroom, and I had my grandmother who made sure that materialistic things I pretty much had what I needed and sometimes what I wanted.
Right.
That created a lot of hostility between my sisters and brothers, but not to the violent part of it, but just comments, like, that's your father did this, he don't do nothing for us. Yeah. So I got it from my brothers and sisters, and also got it from my mother. She referred to him as that man, and when I was around my father, he referred to her as that woman and them kids, so.
Right.
Like,
that's hard for.
Well,
fast forward to, tell me about the incident.
I was incarcerated for?
Yeah.
Well, as I said, it was a state's position that I drove two individuals to a area in Mount Washington in Baltimore.
How old were you?
I just turned 30. Yeah, the crime happened on a Sunday night, on July 29th, I believe, and they said I drove them up there, dropped them off, and they were supposed to just go in and get the money, but the homeowner, it started raining, and the homeowner came home, and he was killed. And I picked him up. I circled the block and picked him up and left. That was the state's version.
And what really happened then?
What really happened is that I was incarcerated already in Eastern District for credit card charges, and the state's position is detective testified that I called him and said, look, I'm in jail for a credit card offense, but let me tell you about this murder that I drove a car in. And they allegedly came and picked me up, and over a month of interrogation that I voluntarily told them that, yeah, I drove the car, and that was the state's entire case. There was no physical evidence. They had an eyewitness that lived next door, said he seen the driver of the car, never seen me a day in his life. Fingerprints were found in the car. They didn't have DNA at that time, but they had fingerprints. None of the fingerprints were mine. The only evidence was alleged voluntary statement. And the detective said that's all the state's case was, that the victim got on the stand, the surviving victim, the wife, she said, she described the crime. Detective got on the stand and said that I voluntarily told him that I drove the car with no deals, no threats, no promises, or nothing. And it took three trials. The first two trials was hung. The first one was a hung jury in front of Elsbeth Booth. Second one was a hung jury in front of James Murphy. But in between time, I had a pretty top-notch lawyer in the beginning, and they made him a judge. So the third time I went in with a public defender, and his attitude was that they ain't got nothing. They haven't found you guilty. And so he just basically just followed the script and laid down on me, and I found guilty. And
you were incarcerated.
Yes, ma'am.
And the detective said that you called.
Voluntarily called him and said, hey, I'm in here for credit cards. They don't carry but 90 days, but let me tell you about this murder I drove a car in.
So he's telling you, if you say this, then
he says,
I can help you out,
I help you out on a credit card charge, and my car was impounded when I was arrested for the credit card charges. So he gave me my car back. Not to me, because I was still incarcerated, waiting to make bail. He gave the car back to my wife, and he said that you don't have to go to city jail. We'll put you in a nice county jail out in Harford County. But he said none of this was deals or threats or promises. They were just trying to be nice.
Yeah, so they were just trying to be nice by enticing you.
That wasn't coercion enough.
Oh, right, of course not. So they were trying to entice you to be a witness against
two other individuals.
Did you know them?
No, they never got charged, never got a day. I'm the only person to serve time in that offense. This is all a matter of public record.
Wow. So you didn't know the people driving the car?
No, I didn't have nothing to do with the crime.
Wow.
But
so
there's a lot of things that happened. Like the car that was used was a red and white Cadillac with New York tags on it. It was stolen from New York. Or I'm originally from New York. I had a history of committing crimes. Right. And they said, this is your turn. You done enough stuff and got away, but this is your turn. And they offered me Said, look, you just get 15 years, which they offered me plea bargain 15 years, and that way, this is a red ball case. This person is a prominent member of the community. You take this one for the team. You do 3 or 4 years, come on out, you know, so.
So, first of all, I want to say I think that just because someone has committed a crime or made a
right.
choice that they're not...
Well, I've done more than my share. I mean, right. I'm being honest with you about that.
Yeah, no, but that doesn't mean that you deserve to be punished for something that you didn't do.
But in the
do.
Real world of the justice system, that's how the game is played. If you're in the system, they didn't just pick me out of the sky, so to speak. I mean, I was on their radar for various things. So when you do things, you know that eventually you're going to jail. And a lot of times it's not for what you did, but that's part of the game. But... I didn't expect that when my turn came, it would be a faulty murder charge and a life sentence, and me serving 37 years, you know.
So you had two hung juries.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, what was the first trial like?
Basically, we picked a jury. Mm-hmm.
Did they look like you? Did they look like me? Were they mixed?
It was mixed jury. Mm-hmm. All right. Like I said, Detective Ronald LaMartina, he got on the stand and he said that what I just told you, that I was in Eastern District for credit card offense, and I told him that if he helped me on the credit card offense, I'd tell him about a murder that I was involved in. Now, I've been on the other side in the system since I was 9. At this time, I'm 30. There's no way I would give the police a time of day unless some kind of deal was involved. That's number one. And number two, I wouldn't trade in a credit card charge and put myself on the radar for murder that they didn't know I existed in
right.
the murder, you know, so.
Yeah, that's just...
But they were looking for somebody that had a nickname New York, and people called me down the street because that's where I'm from. You know, at one time I owned a red and white Cadillac, and so they found out that I was incarcerated, and they just, 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, I'm waiting to get bail on a credit card charge, and they say, we're for homicide, we want to talk to you. You know, and they interrogated me for a month and a half. You know, 1 o'clock in the morning, they get me on the writ, ride me around and stuff. Said, you got to take this for the team. You know, I'm like, you know, I'm not doing that. But then they put dirty pool in the eye. Contrary to what people believe, that when people break the law, they assume that they have no morals whatsoever or no family values. I was married with 2 kids. And they you know, besides giving the car back and other promises, I didn't go for that, but everybody has Achilles heel. And my family is my Achilles heel. And their attitudes, they start saying, well, look, we're gonna go to your house, we're gonna raid your house. Anything we find that you don't have receipts for, we're gonna charge your wife for receiving stolen property and put your kids in the system. You know, and at that point I said, well, whatever y'all wanna do, I'll do it. Just don't mess with my family. But that's how the game was played, basically.
Tell me what the interrogations were like. Like, what would they
First, they were... Like I said, they were just trying to convince me to take one for the team, and we got you, you know, and but then when I refused, then it got ugly, you know. Then it came with the threats. You know.
And how were things with your family at this time? When your wife realized that they were trying to make you?
They thought it was a joke because she knew the night of the crime was on a Sunday night. Everybody knew that I was with my family, that I was at the AFRAM. I came home. I had neighbors that said the crime happened at 9 o'clock. They said I came home about 7:30. We lived in a little small apartment, townhouse, apartment complex. There's no way I could have came in and out with nobody seeing me. And, you know, they came and testified, saying, you know, look, I don't know whether he did it or not, but she said the crime happened. They said the crime happened at 8:45 or something like that. She said at 9 o'clock, I knocked on his door to get my son, because her son was over at my house playing with my kids with the things I had bought him from the AFRAM. She says, so I don't know whether he did it or not. I say, but I know she knows between 7:30 and 9 o'clock. I'm the one to answer the door and call her son to come on downstairs.
Right.
You know.
So
they try to say, the state's attorney cross-examiner tried to say that she had her days mixed up. She said it was a Sunday. I know, you know. This woman, I didn't know her. The only relationship I had with this woman, her kids play with my kids. You know, I couldn't tell you her last name prior to until the trial started if my life depended on it.
So there was no, like, benefit of her she wasn't, like, your best
She had moved. She had moved, and she still came all the way back from Virginia just to say, look, I don't know whether he did it or not. I don't care, but I know on that Sunday night, I know where he was at, you know, so.
Did you testify at your original trial?
Yeah, the first two trials I testified, and I got a hung jury because I told them what I just told you, and they said the same thing. This don't jail right. But when I got the public defender, he's telling me, you don't have to testify. He said, because they don't have nothing. His terms were, they're just pissing in the wind. And I'm telling him, look, some of the piss is getting on me. He said, they ain't got nothing. I'm telling you, you're going to be fine. And he just, You know, I said, well, I want to testify. He said, no. He said, because if you get up there, then they could talk about, they could paint a picture of your history, and you'll get found guilty just based on, you know, your history. So I went along with the attorney because I couldn't conceive me getting found guilty based on a detective just saying I told him that I did it, and he had no physical evidence to support it.
So it sounds like your public defender had a no defense, right?
Well, no, he just felt as though they didn't have no case.
Right.
You know, and he
so
felt as
though. Approved.
Yeah, because like with Mr. Angeletti, like they had somebody from the lab. Let me show you what he didn't do. Mr. Angeletti had the lab person get on the stand and say, yeah, we got comparison prints from the wheel of the car, around the car. None of them were Stanley Mitchell's. When it come time for the third trial, the public defender, he don't put the lab guy on. He lets the state get up and say, oh, we agree that his prints wasn't found. But that's not the same as a live lab person getting on the stand. Right. Otherwise, he cut corners. A lot of things he just proffered instead of actually bringing in live witnesses.
They stipulated that your fingerprints weren't there, so they didn't have the jury.
He agreed to a lot of stipulations. You know, he said, what's the difference? I said, it's a big difference. The guy gets on the stand, a lab guy said, look, we compared prints, and we didn't. Rather than the state say, oh, we agree at the beginning, they stipulated several things into the record.
So your third trial,
right?
It's a jury trial.
Yes, ma'am. All three of them.
And so how long did the trial last before
the first trial?
The last one.
The last one lasted about 8 days. The first one lasted about 23 days.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, and the jury was out 2 days and a half.
So, sitting there knowing that people are saying things that aren't true.
What? Just one person.
Right. Okay. The detective. I mean.
Right. Right.
I'm just wondering how that feels. When somebody tells a lie about me, it makes me angry. But someone tells a lie that affects your life.
I have been in the system before, so I know that. Any type of reaction, whether good or bad, or turns to anger, it would only hurt me. So I just had to sit there and, like, you know, I mean, obviously I did the, like, you know,
right.
You know, but far as like jumping up and banging on that wouldn't serve no useful purpose, you know.
But I never
felt as though that I was gonna get found guilty till they came out the room and said, you know. Find guilty, and that's when it dawned on me. This is crazy.
What went through your mind?
I said, it just got to be a joke. This can't be real. And then I went into you go into survival mode. Okay, well, the next phase is sentencing. So I said, well, in Maryland at that time, and I guess still today, but really at that time, if you got found guilty of a felony murder, you automatically was facing a life sentence. Every now and then the judge was suspect, but rarely. I knew because of who the victim was and the publicity involved in the case, there was going to be no suspended sentence. So I was just waiting to get sentenced to get into the system so I could start the appellate process.
The person who was murdered was a prominent person.
Very prominent.
And so it sounds to me, like when I was reading that's why the police wanted to pin it on somebody.
Yeah, somebody, it's a red, what they call a red ball. Somebody had to fall, you know.
A red ball?
That's what the police call a red ball. Something, a big red ball on their board and something that somebody has to, this case has to be solved. His name was Leo Shapiro. He owned all the partners in all the A&P stores. And he also had all the kosher meat markets for the whole Jewish community in Baltimore.
And the two men, the people who actually...
Nobody ever served a day for this crime but me, and it was the state's vision that I drove the car. No, to this day, nobody ever says, well, what the guys that actually drove the car, you know? Why would he sit in there and drive and just drove the car and not give up the people that was with him, and they was only going to let him do 15 years? Why would he take a life sentence?
Right, it seems like you would have made a much better deal to testify against the people who committed the crime. Yeah. So they say you're guilty.
Right.
Does the judge in Maryland decide the sentence? Or
yes, ma'am.
And so it was life, right?
Yeah, he sentenced me to balance my natural life. He said that I'm not going to suspend any part of the sentence. He said, but I would run the handgun and the armed robbery. He said, I'll run them concurrent, so at some point you'll be a candidate for parole. Right.
So what happened next? Where did you go?
Maryland State Penitentiary. They didn't have diagnostic then. I went to the south wing of the Maryland Penitentiary.
What's it like there? I mean, I've never been there. Tell me about
it. It's lockup. It's It's a part of the jail that they use it for new inmates, but it's also segregation. And you stay there for 2 to 3 weeks, so they classify you to what facility in the state they're going to send you to. But based on my age and my sentence, I knew I was going to stay right there in the penitentiary. I would just move over into population.
Tell me what prison was really like for you.
Well, in the beginning, I had a job prior to my incarceration. As I was employee in city jail teaching, coming in and showing inmates how to fill out resumes and job interviews and stuff. So they felt as though that because I had technically worked in the system, that I might have some problems. So my first 7 years were in solitary confinement. Their attitude was administrative segregation for my own safety. But basically, you're locked in. I don't care what title you put on, you're locked in 23 hours a day. And when you go in on Friday, you get an hour every day except for Saturday and Sunday. So after you get your hour Friday, you don't come out no more until Monday.
So you were in solitary confinement?
7 years. 7 years. Yes, ma'am.
How did that feel?
Well, you know, I read a lot of Reader Digest. They said this before you had TVs and radios. When I first went to the penitentiary, they gave you rented a pair of headphones for $1.50, and they had a James Brown radio station, a gospel station, and a sports station, and you had to pick what you want to listen to. Or you could read, or you could write, or you could exercise until you passed out, you know. So as years went by, then they start off with little portable radios, then they start black and white TVs, then at one point, you know, you basically had what stereo system, big TV, what, you know, whatever. There was just, you know, but in the beginning, the first 4 or 5 years, just me, books, and some paper.
Stanley spent 7 years in solitary confinement. We'll talk more about that right after a sponsor break. I've been so busy with all of the projects I have going on lately. I finally decided it's time for some help. It's hard, though, because I know it'll take the right person to make my project successful. With ZipRecruiter, I can post my jobs to over 100-plus sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology matches the right people to the job that's posted. In fact, over 80% of jobs on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. Plus, it saves me time because I don't have to juggle emails and calls from interested people. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/actual. To try it for free, that's ZipRecruiter.com/actual. One more time. To try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/actual.
I can't imagine. I mean, solitary confinement for your own benefit right. Doesn't sound like it's right. For anybody's
benefit. But it's always a matter of record, what I'm telling you, so it's,
right.
You know.
I know you're right. I'm just, it's hard for me to hear from you because I'm sorry. Like, I wish there was
for what? You didn't do it. Like you did. I mean, you know, like I tell everybody, you know, I didn't do this, but I done my share, and I put myself in that position by being on a radar in the first place. You know, so I got to take some blame for it. You know, if I hadn't chose to make the decisions that I made, I would have never been in a radar in the first place, and I might have not been in this situation. But I always try to look at everything as a blessing, not then, but now, because I realize that I missed the AIDS epidemic. I missed the crack epidemic. And with the lifestyle I was living, I probably would have my brains blowed out anyway, you know, because the street life changed now. It's changed over the years. There's no morals. There was never really a whole lot of morals and values in the street, or some honor among thieves, as they say. But as in the, you talk about the 80s and the 90s, the period of years I was incarcerated, it all went to hell. You know, everybody's for everybody, you know. So it's altogether a different game now.
So what, did you get to see, you had a wife and two children?
At that time.
Did you get to see them while you were locked up?
I got locked up in August 1st, 1978, and my wife died December 1986. Yeah.
How old were your children when she?
When I went to prison, the oldest was 7, and the youngest was 4.
So where did they go? Where did they go after?
Well, they stayed with my wife.
But, yeah. But
after she died, her sister raised them.
Her sister. Right. And did you get to see them? Like
regularly, until they got I guess when they got about 18, when they start getting like teenage, the relationship, the dynamics change because, I mean, I don't know what it is. Teenagers, you know, like they would come to see me and they'd be, somebody would come and say, I know him, and they would hide. And I say, what are you hiding for? And they're like, I don't want that girl to see me visiting here. I say, she's visiting somebody. I mean, but you know, I mean, just, right. You never, logic, who knows, you know?
Right.
And like I said, as they got older, they came, but periodically, you know. But when they were younger, they were there. And like I said, birthdays, I sent them money, birthday cards. If I seen something I might think they might like around the prison, I would buy, get their portraits done, little stuff like this. So we had the best relationship as you could have under the circumstances.
That's awesome that you were able to be a good dad, even though you had this horrible thing happen.
Well, even though I made my living doing illegal acts, I wasn't what you call a street person. I never hung in clubs, bars, none of that stuff. I mean, you know, when I'm the one that picked him up from school. I did the PTA, the Little League practice, all that type of stuff, you know. So, you know, we had a somewhat of a relationship. Now, is when I came home, it's the youngest, you know, we're not on the same team. When I first came home, we were, but there's a lot of resentment, you know, on his part, you know. The oldest one, it's altogether different, you know. He's just glad that I'm out. You know, he's doing good. He's a school teacher, you know. Yeah, he's a school teacher. He's a Mason. He's got a master's degree. You know, he's a math teacher in Baltimore City. Then he's a JV coach. You know, I go to his games. He comes to see me on a regular basis. He comes out to the house. You know, we go to church together. I mean, he claims that he's proud of me because how I came home and I just...
And you're somebody.
Yeah,
you're making good choices.
Yeah. And he said a lot of his friends when he was coming up, you know, his friends could go to their daddy and get money and stuff, or the daddy would take him stuff and I wasn't there and he felt bad. He said, but now flash forward, you know, I'm dressing nice, driving a nice car, I'm trying to do the right thing. And the same guys, they're standing on the corner selling loose ones for 50 cents, you know, so he's pretty, you know, they're fathers, you know, so he...
That's awesome.
You know, so he says that he's proud of me, but, you know, I say, man, I'm proud of you. Your mother died when you were young. I went to prison, and now you're driving a brand new Benz. You're a school teacher. You got a house in Columbia. I say,
is he single?
No. Yeah. He got married. He got two kids. I met McNair in college and Oral Roberts in Oral Roberts College. So, you know.
So we're sitting here talking now.
Yes, ma'am.
So obviously you're not in prison anymore.
No, ma'am.
Can you tell me about your journey to get out? What happened?
Well, over the years, I tried everything, every kind of way you could think of legally, you know, all kinds of motions, the innocent projects, I did the whole gamut. And I started getting sick, you know, high blood pressure, stress. I was getting, you know,
right.
I think maybe... 2013, I think maybe 2011. There was a guy that I knew from the penitentiary named Franco. He's a client of Rachel's. Mm-hmm. And I was telling him that I was trying to get a modification, think I'd get my time cut. And he was saying that, well, I know an attorney, that's what she specializes in. So I said, okay, is she reasonable? So she said, yeah, Gabe, so give her a call. And I think he told her that, you know, I was a good guy. So I called her, and she told me send all her paperwork, right? And she said that, you know, I said, okay. I said, you know, this is all the money I got. So by this time, I had another wife, right? And
you got married again while you were in prison?
Yeah, a couple years before I came. She contacted Rachel, made the financial arrangements. Then I sent Rachel all my paperwork, and then she got involved because she was saying that, you know, this is not cool. And so... she said that, you know, we're going to get you out, you know. So, because I gave her everything I could possibly give. I mean, the degrees, the certificates, letters from guards, stopping a woman from getting raped, all the stuff. She said, there's no way in your health this not going to happen. We got the right judge, you know, on paper. This judge is the most liberal. And, you know, I thought I had something come. But I always told Rachel, I said, look, you might not see it on the surface, I said, but there's still a lot of resentment about who this man was, right? But she didn't believe me, right? See, they caught off guard, right? Because she was like, no, that's not gonna happen. I said, all right, you know, I said, just because I would never, she kept saying, why don't you smile about this? You're getting out, I'm telling you. She had contacted, found out how many days I had to do my good time. It was all set up, you know, for me just to go to court, and I would be out in a week or so. But I kept on, like, and she said, we got this. You're going to be, and I'm saying, all right, you know.
It's and, easier to have hope when you're out here.
Yeah, but she was, I tried to explain to her that there was a whole lot of stuff behind the scenes in this case because who this individual was, somebody had to fall. And nobody's going to get up, especially after I done studied 35 years, the whole we made a mistake. So we were in front of the judge, and the judge took us down there for 3 hours. I had a whole lot of people show up to the courtroom, family members, different people. And she had all of them get on the stand and say something good about it. You would think the judge was my lawyer, because when the state's attorney got up to say something crazy, the judge said, he's not the same person, so we're not gonna talk about that, right? And then the judge said, you know, Mr. Mitchell, you know what's going on here. And I said, yeah, so what that mean? I said, she's gonna slam me. And then she says, I don't change judges' sentences. She said, the judge that gave you the sentence is deceased, he wanted you to do life, and that's what I want you to do. And just walked off the bench, and everybody was like, why the, you know, she could have denied the motion with a, right. Most people, everybody, that's nothing. Everybody said, if she wasn't gonna cut you loose, she wouldn't have called you down, and you're gonna get right. Something, you right. Know, because most people get, when you file a modification, say motion denied, you know, so everybody was crying, racial including everything, and so then I said, well, we're gonna try to get some more money. She said, no, don't do that. She said, I told her, I said, well, I'm one of the Unger, I said, I guess the Unger issue is jury instructions. And she said, well, I got a friend that's handling the Unger case, she said. And I said, well, how much money? She said, you don't need nothing. She made a call. And next thing I know, about a week later, 2 weeks later, the guy from the public defender's office said, Michael Middleton has got your case. We're going to get you out on this Unger thing. And that was, that happened in November. And May, I got a phone call saying, you're coming home in June 20th of 2013. This was like 6 months later.
How did that book feel?
Well, there was a problem with that too, because I told them I'm not taking no deal. I'm not pleading guilty. I'm not saying admitting to nothing. I'm not reporting to nobody. You know, I said I want my trial, because on the Unger station, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but basically it says that we get everybody to get tried before 1980. They had a jury trial, got faulty instructions. All right, because the judges was telling the juries that this is the law, but if you don't like the law, you can change it in Maryland, because you are the judges of the law in effect. So you basically do what they could do what they wanted to. The courts ruled in 81 that was illegal, but they didn't make it retroactive. And then Merle Unger, who's an inmate, he wrote a book, got some money, got a high-priced lawyer. One of them worked in another firm with Rachel, and he got the courts to say, we're making it retroactive. So, but the state wasn't caught off guard, because they said, well, how many guys could be in prison after 40 years, 35, 40 years? They didn't know there was like 500, 600 of us, right? They start saying, we're going to fight. But every time they would go to court and fight, they would lose, right? So then the state's attorney said, I'm tired of losing. Let's just make deals. And they'd start doing it based on your conduct in the facility, who had the best home plan, and that's the order we got out in. Like that, and I was on the first, obviously first load, right?
I really admire your integrity that you do not want to take a deal and admit to something you didn't do.
My family wasn't too keen about it. They said, look, you're 60-some years old, you got heart pressure, you got all this stuff, you know, we come on out, and if you want to fight it, we do that later. I said, I'm not doing none of that. You know, I said, I could have took 15 years, 30 years ago, I could have been home. You know, I said, it's not about moral or integrity. I said, it's just don't.
Personal.
Yeah, I'm not doing that, right? And, you know, the lawyer said, all right. And so he talked to the state's attorney, and the state's attorney, he had read the transcript. He said, man, I don't know what happened back then with this. He said, but look, you don't report to nobody, fine. He said, you don't have to say nothing in the courtroom. All you got to do is give us an address where we can get in touch with you. And I was in the courtroom all the 2 minutes. I came in, and the judge said, you know why you're here? I said, yeah. He said, you got an address for us? I said, yeah. He said, all right. Report probation in 48 hours, and get him an address. And after a year, everything's over.
Hear what it was like for Stanley to be free right after our final sponsor break. On days I don't feel like cooking or have run out of aforementioned meal delivery service meals, I turn to RX Bar. RX Bar started in 2013 by calling BS on protein bars. They couldn't find a bar out there that wasn't full of artificial ingredients, fillers, and preservatives. That's why they created a bar with a few simple, clean ingredients, where every ingredient serves a purpose. It turns out, real food ingredients actually taste really good. You can taste the cocoa, the real fruit, the spices, like sea salt. Whether you like sweet or savory, chocolate or fruit flavors, there's an RX bar for you. RX bars come in 11 delicious flavor varieties. They're gluten-free, soy-free, dairy-free, with no added sugar, no artificial colors, artificial flavors, preservatives, or fillers. They use natural things like egg whites for protein, dates to bind, and nuts for texture. For 25% off your first order, visit rxbar.com/actual and enter the promo code ACTUAL.
A year
Tell
later.
Me about the day that you went home.
Well, it was interesting. I mean, you know.
Because you have a wife that you haven't lived with before, right?
That's correct.
How did that?
Well, you know, I met her in 2010. I came home 2000. Well, I met her, yeah, 2010. We got married 2011. I came home 2013.
I love a love story. How did you meet?
My sister-in-law, my first wife's sister-in-law, was coming to see me pretty regular, bringing my kids to see me all the years. And one day I came into the viz room to see her. And my wife had a cousin that was in there. And when I came by, her cousin was serving life too. When I came by, I spoke to her cousin. I say, what's up? He said, how you doing, old man? And I said, you know, I sat down with my visit. So about a couple days later, I seen him. He said, hey, my cousin said, here go her number. She wants you to call. I said, she want me to call her for? Right? He said, man, I don't know. She said, she wants you to call her. You know, I said, all right. So I finally, about a week later, I had nothing to do. I called her. I said, I'm sorry, I'm staying on your. She said, yeah, how you doing? I said, I'm all right. She said, how long you been in there? So I told her 35, 36 years, something like that. She said, when you getting out? I said, never. She said, what do you mean never? I said, I got life. I said, you know, I just got turned down. I said, this is where I'm going to be. You know, I said, you know, so I'm 60-some years old. I got forever. What do you want to, you know, she said, this is what she says, you know. Because I thought she was from another planet. She says, well, something about it, when you came by and you spoke, God put something on my heart to contact you, she said, because you just don't look like you should be in here. I said, well, I'm supposed to have horns and tails. You know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah,
you know, because I was real sarcastic about it, because at this stage, I don't have time. I don't have time. I don't need nobody to send me no tennis. I said, no pen pal. I don't need no commissary money. I said, you know, also, if it ain't about getting me out. And she said, well, you know, I work for a lawyer. She said, I've been working for a law firms for a while, right? So she said, is anything I could do? I said, well, sometimes I need copies made, papers taking place. She said, I could do that for you. And that's how it started. She was just assisting me, you know.
When you're in prison right. and you get married,
right.
do you have a wedding? Like, how does that work?
Right. Well, I had to go to the chaplain and the jail chaplain. And at that time, I was in the Sunni religion. I told him, I said, look, I need I need approval to marry and I had to fill out some forms.
I'm sorry, what religion did you say?
I was Sunni Muslim at this time. He said that you had to fill out some forms, and he has to interview me, interview her, make sure we're not doing it to avoid no charges. Right. There's no restraining order and all this other stuff. And on Tuesdays, there's no visits. So they do weddings on Tuesdays.
That's amazing.
You know, we tried to do a Valentine's Day, and he said, no, they couldn't do that year. He said, so the earliest we get it was March 1st. So we got married March 1st. It was, like I said, her daughter came. She had, at that time, she had 12 and a half year old daughter's 20 now. And she came, and it was her and her daughter. And we got married, and they let us visit for about an hour. She went on about her business, and I went on back to my cell, and you know.
So you get released and you go see this woman that you're married to. What was it like? What was it like going home?
It was strange. I mean, the first thing when we got home, we came outside because I went to court at 2, but they didn't let us go till like 6 o'clock. We had to wait till the jailhouse count cleared. So I came out, I had nothing on, but they took the shirt from me. They took the DOC shirt, I had a white t-shirt, some thick jeans and some boots. And the social workers were there from the University of Maryland saying that I need a, you know, toothpaste brush. I said, I just want to get away from this courthouse. That's all I want to do. I said, I don't want to cut y'all off or nothing. I said, but I want to get away from here, right? And they understood.
Yeah.
And I hugged them and told them, look, I appreciate if you gave my life back. I said, but I just want to get out of here.
Yeah.
And so we went to the parking lot and I have my little photo album stuff, threw that in the trunk. And the first thing that shocked them is that I opened the car doors for them. They weren't used to it. They said, "What are you doing?" I said, "So, you know, but it's just a habit. It's open the car door." And then my daughter, she was getting ready to get in the back seat. I said, it's just been her and her mother for these. So I said, "No." I said, "You usually ride up front. I get in the back." So they said, "Well, what you want to do?" I said, "Well, two things." I said, "I'm hungry because I haven't eaten a couple of days, and I want to get out these clothes, right?" And she had brought me some things, but the pants didn't fit, so we had to go to the mall get some pants that fit.
What was it like going to the mall?
Strange.
After having been in prison?
It was strange. Yeah, I mean, it's like you feel like the scar, everybody staring at you. You know, it's what the analogy that I usually give when I talk to people. It's like you're crawling, everybody else is on a Segway. Everybody's just swiping by you, and you're trying to see everything, and you're not seeing nothing, you know. And noises, I get a real bad headache because I'm not used to hearing kids hollering, car horns. I mean, you know, it was. And then she said, "Well, do you want to call anybody?" I said, "Not really."
I was going to ask you the cell phone question.
Yeah, I said, "Not really." And so she said, "Well, why don't you call your sister? Like, she's been with you for 40-some years, Vince." And I said, "Yeah, all right." So she called her for me. So she gave me the phone. I said, "Well, I don't know what to do." I said, "Contrary to popular belief, everybody don't have no cell phone in prison."
Right.
I said, "I never had nobody that was worth me risking it 3 years for just to talk to on the phone that I couldn't do on the regular phone."
Yeah.
Right. So they dialed a number for me, handed me the phone. So I called my sister-in-law. So she said, "Why do people didn't say collect call?" I said, "Because I'm out." Because I didn't tell them at the first letdown. I didn't tell my family nothing. Nobody knew about it but me and Gina. And so she said, "Stop playing." I said, "She said, you got one of them damn cell phones." I said, No. I said, "We're out on the highway." See, so I stuck the car. I said, "You hear the horns and stuff?" So she said, "Where you going now?" I said, "I'm going to," she had got an apartment for us and everything. She said, "I'm going to her house, her mother's house, and we'll get some things that she got there, and then we're going out to our place and, you know, put the beds together and stuff like that." And so she said, "You come here the first thing tomorrow morning?" I said, "Yeah, because I got to go to Baltimore to get my address." And then soon I hung up. About 10 minutes later, my son called, my youngest son. He called, like, "Sibby said you out." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you coming to my house?" I said, "No." I said, I'm going out to Fort Washington. And he said, "No, man, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. You got to come by here." And I'm like, "Man," I said, "I'll come by tomorrow." He said, "Man, I done wait." He crying. "I done wait all these years." I said, all right. It was the last game of the NBA playoffs. And I went to his house. We stayed at 3 o'clock in the morning until the game was over. Then we went home. And I ate, took a shower, and put the bed.
How did it feel? How did the shower feel? Like your own shower by yourself?
Well, it was strange because we was around the house for a few minutes, right, putting stuff up, and I had to go to the bathroom, so I just went and sat on the toilet, but left the door open.
Right.
And she was like, you got comfortable all fast. You ain't close the door." I said, "It's just a habit. I used to go in the bathroom around a million people." I said, "Plus you, my wife, was the big deal, right?" And so, you know, then I put the beds together, and be honest, we just went to sleep. You know, then the next day I went to see the probation officer, and a guy that came out with me had died that night. So they called me and was telling me that, "Look, go home, just sit in the tub if you ain't got air conditioned." Yusef, that's the guy that came out and said he passed away from doing too much too fast. He was like 72. And his first night, he was running around trying to see everybody. And so, you know, I basically didn't do too much of nothing. Like I said, and she took a week off from work. And like I said, I couldn't go in the bathroom for 5 minutes while her knocking on the door, like, you all right? You know, I mean, every 2 minutes, it was like, you all right, you know? And, you know, I just, the first week, then after a week went by, then she, that Monday, she went back to work, and she called every hour, you know. The daughter was there with me because it was summer, because she was off from school. And she told her every time I go somewhere to make sure she go with me, and, you know, so.
So right now, sitting in front of me, I see a very well-dressed, a very well-spoken, a very confident person. Tell me about yourself now. What is your life like now?
Well, obviously, I'm not the same person. I'm older and a little wiser. I do things a little different now. I do things a lot slower. I I think of the consequences. I know it's the world doesn't revolve around Stanley. You know, for the world to exist, there has to be rules, and if you break them rules, there's consequences. I know that there are people that would love to see me fail, but I know there are more people that want to see me be successful. And I don't want to let nobody down that's invested their time and emotions in me. That helps a lot. Because when I was in prison, everybody else would ask me, well, how did you survive? Ready, you're guilty, innocent. How did you survive 30-some, 3 decades in prison? Well, I was fortunate enough that I always knew that somebody cared whether I lived or died. See, now, a lot of guys in prison, they start letting us pay for your own phone calls, and they could call people, and people still wouldn't take their call, and they're paying for it. You know, they don't get visits. They don't get mail. And I always had somebody. I didn't always had to be a family member. Over the years, I'd have met a whole lot of girls. I mean, and like, somebody would always, if they don't hear from me, somebody don't hear from me in a week, they would call the jail and say, look, is he all right? And we have something. If he's got the call, you know. So I always knew that somebody cared whether I lived or died. So if they care, I'm going to care. You know, so
support of the people in your life was key.
Yeah, it wasn't financial. It was just that they would,
like just being there for you. Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
I never felt as though that I was alone, you know. And I was alone because I'm not from this area, so I didn't have no homeboy, so to speak. I didn't have no East Side friends, West Side friends. I didn't have none of that because I'm New York boy, you know. So I had to make it on my name and on respect, you know, so.
What advice would you give to someone who you found in your position who's in prison or being accused of something that they didn't do? How?
I tell everybody the same thing. The first thing, if you find yourself in prison, don't do nothing stupid. It's going to keep you longer than you have to. So if a door does open, don't let nobody be able to stand and say, well, he stabbed so-and-so. He got caught with a dirty urine here. I say, don't do nothing that's going to give somebody another nail to keep you in there if you do get one nail out, you know.
A lot of times I get emails or calls from people who want to know how they can help.
When a person comes out and they're out for a little while, try not to look at what they were accused of doing. Look at them as who they are today, not who they were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 30, definitely 40 years ago. And because if you stay concentrating on who this person was, and a lot of us did have horns and tails, you'll never be able to assist them today because you're always going to see who that person was. So unless they do something to make you think that they still that person, look at them as who they are, who's standing in front of you, not what you read, not what you heard. Judge them on who they are right in front of you. And also make sure that there's some period of time that they are carrying this torch. They're not, you know, what they say, 90 days, the average guy goes back, or a year. Tell me about 2 or 3 years, and the guys, you know, start looking at them who they are today. And that's as far as when they're coming out. When somebody's in prison and they tell you that they didn't do it, or even if they did do it, they still need help. But let's say if they tell you that they didn't do it, there's very little you can do as a non-attorney in terms of helping them get out, right? But you have to read the case, study the individual, and make your decision on your gut. If you feel as though this person really didn't do it, then let him know that or he or she know that you believe in them. Right. You know, it's not financial. A lot of people think it's financial, but no, you have to let them know that you believe in them. So then gives them strength. They say, somebody else cares about me. So I know somebody believes me. Now, if every door they turn on says, oh, just this another guy in prison, everybody in prison is innocent. And that's not true. Guys, I don't know where they get this myth from that everybody walks around saying that everybody's in their prison. That's not true. Well, a lot of guys will sell you this. I'm innocent in the way that they got me. They didn't get me right. All right. They lied. I did that, but they lied and they cheated on how they did it. All right. I had 20 bags of dope, but they said I had 500 bags of dope. They said I was making $50 a day. They said I was making $1 million a day. I mean, that's what they mean when guys say that, well, they didn't get me right. That's basically when they're saying they're innocent. They're saying they're not getting me right. But 95% of the guys in there, they will tell you basically what happened if they feel as though that you can't cause them no harm. I mean, and I the worst thing you can do in prison is walk around telling people that you're innocent, because they're co-social workers, classification counselors, you know. I never tried to convince them that, because a lady told me when I first came in, she said, look, I don't care whether you did it or not. I wasn't there. State of Maryland said that you did it, and I'm here as, this is my job, to make sure that you get this and get this while you're here. I'm not, you know, so you're wasting your breath trying to convince, and then when you tell them that you didn't do it, they done heard it so much that you turn them off, you know. So your best bet is, if you're trying to get out, is don't debate the state's version with anybody that in the facility. Courts, you tell the courts what really happened. You tell your lawyer what really happened. But anybody else, guards, social workers, because as far as they're concerned, 12 people found you guilty. You're there. You must have done something. So you're wasting your breath and your time. And it turns them off from assisting you, because they say, oh, this is another guy. So it's best not even to argue the state's version to try to tear it down, you know. So I always say, I said, the state of Maryland convinced 12 people that I did this. I disagree, but this is what they say happened. And I let it go. You know, if they want to find out the facts, like I said, it's a public record. I said, don't take my word for it. Read the record.
Stanley's in the process of writing a book. When his book is released, I will be happy to share that information with all of you. I'm Brooke. Thanks so much for listening. A special thank you to our sponsors for supporting today's episode. Remember, if you can't financially help our sponsors, you can still give them a thank you on social media. Visit our website, Actual In Pod, for more information, and check out our new podcast, Convicted, on your favorite podcast app. Our theme song is by Andy Cohen. Until next time, listen, learn, and advocate for justice. Thanks again, and always, for listening.
Hi, this is Christy Lee, host of the Canadian True Crime Podcast. My podcast tells Canadian stories of cruel people who committed heinous acts and honors innocent victims who are no longer with us. I start with a deep dive into the story of Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka, with information you probably haven't heard, and then I venture into some lesser-known Canadian crime stories. You can find me on your favorite podcast app. Just search for Canadian True Crime.
They Walk Among Us is a podcast exploring the UK's most sinister and surreal crimes, including the woman who killed the boyfriend as he spent too much time on Facebook, to the teenage boys whose online relationship involves spies, sex, and the near-fatal stabbing of one of them. Subscribe on iTunes or your favourite podcast provider.